Welcome to You, Me, Empathy, a safe place for leading with your heart. Hey, thanks for being here. You, Me, Empathy is the official podcast of the Feely Human Collective, a collaborative mental health community designed to empower each of us to grow our capacity for empathy, vulnerability, and emotional wayfinding. Just a friendly reminder that this podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only and is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. No one is just a silly boy with a feely heart. You can support the show by leaving a review in Apple Podcasts, following us on social media at Yumi Empathy and Feely Human, and joining the Feely Human Collective community at feelyhuman.co. And now your host, Noan Wells.
Hello, Feely Humans. Welcome to another episode of You, Me, Empathy. My name is Noan Wells. I'm the creator of this show. I'm also the founder of the Feely Human Collective, where we together, like Care Bears, grow our capacity for empathy, vulnerability, and emotional curiosity. Happy you're here. So grateful you're here and listening. This is episode 233 on high-risk humans with my guest, Madison Thorne. Madison is a photography person. She's a photographer, is what I meant to say. And I really love this conversation. We talk about why fixing all the problems of others doesn't lead to being seen and loved. We talk about the near-death experience of being diagnosed with type 1 diabetes at 27 years old, and how a sign that said, "Sacrifice the weak," inspired Madison to create this photography series called High Risk Humans, which shares the stories of those the CDC classified as high risk in the early days of the pandemic. And it shares those stories, it uplifts those voices. It's really special. And we talked a lot about that and a bunch of other things, including, fun fact, Madison's work with the legendary Dolly Parton. So hope you enjoy this conversation. Before we get to it, just a couple of reminders. Please subscribe, leave a rating and review for You, Me, Empathy in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to this show. It does help out the show. I am an independent podcaster. I do all of this on my own. I have other stuff I do, work, part-time jobs, Airbnb host, doggo, protector. And it helps. It does help. And I love reading them when they come in. So thank you for leaving a rating and review in Apple Podcasts. The other thing I wanted to mention, if you haven't heard, I am in the process of building out a membership community for Feely Human. I said it would be ready in October. I'm not sure if that's going to happen, but maybe toward the end of the year, maybe by January, but look forward to that. I will be sending out a survey soon via the newsletter, so make sure to sign up for the newsletter. Go to feelyhuman.co, click that banner at the top there and sign up. I'll be sending out a survey that will basically have a bunch of ideas. I have a bunch of ideas for this community. I don't want to overwhelm myself or you in the process, so I want to gauge what type of stuff that you want to see. So make sure to sign up for the newsletter. You'll hear about that pretty soon here. And the last thing I'll say is, are you taking care of yourself? Are you, in this conversation with Madison, we talk a little bit about how we have both, and her, she shares, we have both been people who have in our past, recent or otherwise past, been people who have sort of given all of ourselves to others to the detriment of ourselves. So I wanted this to be a reminder to you, listener, to take care of yourself. Check in. Ask how you're feeling. Ask why you're helping in the first place. That's important. Because it is true. We have to give empathy to ourselves before we give empathy to others. It's so important. So this is your reminder to do that because you deserve it. You deserve it. Okay, let's get to the episode. Episode 233 on high-risk humans with Madison Thorne.
Mm-hmm. Empathy. Empathy.
Welcome to You, Me, Empathy, the official podcast of the Feely Human Collective. On this show, we explore the struggles, the triumphs, the brights and the darks we face as humans trying to get by on this wondrous and overwhelming pale blue dot. The intent of You, Me, Empathy is to talk openly without judgment about our mental health, our neuroses, our shared anxieties and worries, to create a dialogue that is vulnerable and deeply human and empathetic, and to share that dialogue with others to inspire emotional and cognitive collaboration and insight so we can, hand in hand, break down the stigma that make us feel shame and guilt for struggling, for feeling our feelings, for being feely humans. You, Me, Empathy is a brave place designed to inspire the beauty in each of us because each of us, in all of our kaleidoscopic parts, make up a magical whole that deserves to be seen. Today, I'm grateful to see in another way. Today, I'm grateful to see another view into the way we feely humans can access empathy with the photographer behind the COVID-19 photography series, High Risk Humans. It's Madison Thorne. Hello, Madison.
Hey, Noan. How's it going?
It's going all right. How are you?
I'm okay. That was a great introduction. Thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. So let's get right into it. Emotional check-in. We always kick off the show with an emotional check-in. How are you feeling? Like, really feeling?
Feeling. Well, thank you for the check-in. I know you do it with everyone, but I still appreciate it. I feel saturated with emotions right now. Honestly, I was listening to a couple of your episodes just to try and get in the mindset a little bit. And I connected with so much of what some of your guests had to say. And it's a broad range of connections. So, like, Will Wheaton was on here talking about traumatic childhoods, and you had Claire Bidwell-Smith talking about sitting with grief and all of that stuff. And then your wonderful little episode about how vaccines are an act of empathy at this point. And I felt all of the feelings walking into this interview, which is probably a good thing. It's a little overwhelming, and that's okay.
Overwhelming is okay. I feel overwhelmed on a daily basis. It's sort of part of it, I think. I think it's part of it especially for sensitive feely types, right? Who are sort of engaged in hard things or doing hard things in the world. Thank you for listening. I should hire you to promote Yumi Empathy.
it's so fantastic. And I think what my favorite part of it is that you're talking about subjects that make us feel isolated. So, like, grief makes us feel isolated. And like, rule number one of a traumatic childhood is that you don't talk about it. So it's incredibly isolating. And so you're shedding light on these subjects, and you're making it okay to talk about them. You're making it okay to feel these feelings. So I'm really glad to be here and talking with you today.
Oh, that's nice. I think one important thing about what you said, you know, in terms of your reflecting on various episodes that you've listened to, there are so many ways into this stuff, right? There are so many ways that we humans can relate and can empathize with each other. And I think the beauty of empathy is that we don't necessarily have to have had the same exact experience, but we've lived on this planet as a human whose experience may be grief in a way that's different than the way Claire has experienced it, or parental trauma in the way that Will has experienced it. Like, mine's different, but I still relate and connect and, you know, see him. And that's the beauty of empathy. And I think one of the sort of ongoing themes of this show is, like, let's broaden and widen our scope for what empathy can be, rather than like, oh, I have to have the same experience as you, Madison, and you and vice versa, right? I think it's so much more powerful than that. And I think you shared that as an example of that that empathy, the multitudes of empathy, the myriad powers of empathy. It's a beautiful thing. So happy you're here.
Oh, thank you, man. Yeah, empathy can change the world, and it's a simple act, but it's very hard to teach. So I always like discussing it with people and talking about how we can spread the good word, if you will.
Yeah, and I think it's an act, but it's also an ongoing thing, right? It's mm-hmm. it's something that one can do, and that's sort of like the maybe the tail end of the work, right? That's the compassionate empathy. But the empathy that I think is hard for, has been hard for me, has been hard for others, is the piece that's like, what are you doing inside your heart? What kind of curiosity are you getting into? How are you examining your assumptions and bias? Are you being aware? Are you bringing awareness to your intent and impact and how you show up in the world and spaces and school and work and, you know, all these things? That's the stuff that that lights me up, but I want to think about more. Anyways, I'm like a televangelist when it comes to empathy.
We're on the same page, man. It's a beautiful thing. And yeah.
So tell me, what was your childhood like? Tell me a little bit about Stark. Yeah. U-turn. We're going straight into it.
We're going. Whoo. Sorry. Thanks for that good laugh. That was great.
Maybe give me a seminal moment or two from your childhood that like stick out to you as being sort of important.
Wow. Okay. This is cool. Everything's fine. It's all good. So my parents divorced when I was 10, and I don't like to go into too much detail, like publicly, because, out of respect for my brothers, and though we grew up in the same household, we all have different views of how things went down. And so try to be respectful of them and their experiences.
Mm-hmm.
But from my childhood, I remember trying to take care of everybody else. And I was the fixer. And I thought if I could fix every problem that came along, then I would be loved and then everything would be okay. And I didn't realize till many, many years later, actually, when I got diagnosed with type 1, that I never asked myself how I was doing. Mm-hmm. So it took me till I was 27 years old to ask myself how I was feeling and why I was feeling that way. That was the lasting. There were many, many good parts to my childhood, and there were many sad parts. So it's all about.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate you sharing, and I don't want to make you share anything you're uncomfortable sharing. What I will say is that I also had a different experience than my siblings growing up. And a sort of a direct result of some of that is I don't have a relationship with my father, and they do, right? And mm-hmm. that has been a point of contention that has been hard for them. And it's been important for me to share my experience because it's valid, right? I think mm-hmm. what is a crucial piece of sort of our upbringing is we can experience a father, in my case, right, who was scary or violent, etc. And each kid has their own sensitivity to that. Each kid experiences that in a different way. My sister and I got the brunt of it. You know, my younger brothers didn't. And so we had different experiences, right? Mm-hmm. And I would never presume to take away or invalidate their experience with it, right? I don't understand, nor do I diminish their relationship with my father. That's great. They can have that. For me, that doesn't make sense. For me, that's a boundary I need to create, but that doesn't invalidate my experience or how I'm responding to that experience. And it doesn't invalidate their experience. Right. So I am sensitive to that. I just noticed you bring up the fact that, like, you know, I want to be sensitive to the fact that, like, they may have had different experiences, and I get that. And I'm sensitive to that as well, but I hope it also doesn't diminish the sort of the seeking and the curiosity that you may need to do to explore some of those experiences. Because I know a crucial part of my journey, and it's not for everyone, has been to kind of explore my childhood experiences, not to live there, but to understand, right? Because what I'm hearing from you also, and I share this, is like being a helper, being a fixer, being like the one that sort of took on stuff. There's a lot of, you're not knowing about yourself during that period. You're denying a big part of yourself, right? So
yes,
going back and exploring your childhood through the lens of like, okay, maybe I want to get to know myself a little bit more is a beautiful gift, I would say.
Absolutely. That's inner child work. And now's a great time to plug that that book of yours.
Do Your Childhood Me.
Yeah, there you go. I pre-ordered that. I'm looking forward to that. That's new for me, trying to go back and look at that situation now that I'm kind of, I guess, removed from it. You know, I don't live in my hometown anymore. I'm standing on my own two feet. I'm stable emotionally, physically, mentally. So I feel like now I have the opportunity to kind of take that book off the shelf, like start doing that grief work. I have a wonderful therapist that I love very much, and she's been had her for over a year now. She's great, and we've done a lot of work, and it's not that I'm not willing to talk about this stuff. I actually love having this conversation with people, but you and I right now are in a very public setting. So as I said, with respect to my siblings, if you want to have this conversation while you're not recording it, I'd be happy to.
But, no, it's totally fair. And I appreciate that. And I'm truly not trying to make you to talk about anything you don't want to talk about.
No, I understand that. I appreciate you sharing. It's difficult.
Yeah. So the last thing I'll say about this, and this is to you, Madison, and this is to the listeners, is like, healing, you know, the broad sort of spectrum umbrella of healing is nonlinear, and it's messy, and it's weird, and it's different for everyone, right? So just because the way that I have healed some of my past wounds doesn't necessarily mean it's going to apply to you, Madison, right? So I would never want to like put that upon anyone. And also, I think that the stuff just takes time too, often like a life's work of time, you know? So
absolutely.
I think what is important is that you're aware of it and you're in therapy, and that's beautiful. Yeah. And I guess I wonder for you now, like knowing that about yourself, knowing that you had that experience growing up where you felt like the fixer, like how are you, how do you see yourself now? Do you still see yourself as a fixer, like, let me take care of the situation type of person now?
Yes, but I can do so safely. You know, I hate the phrase, like, not my problem, right? I feel like that's very dismissive. When someone, when you talk about somebody's issues or something like that, and you say, well, that's not my problem. It's dismissive. I don't like it. So in my head, what I say is it's not my burden. So if someone comes to me with a problem or an issue, we can talk it out. We can try and find the best solutions. We can work through it together, but it doesn't have to be my burden. I don't have to put it on my shoulders. And it's, like I said, it's helping me move through a lot of relationships safely. I don't feel like I'm being dragged down. And, you know, I was letting myself be dragged down. Nobody put that weight on my shoulders. I put that weight on my shoulders. And so
Yeah. That's great. I love that. What a good insight. And just a simple change of language. I love that. It's not my burden.
Exactly. Yeah. I just had that realization maybe, you know, just a few months ago, and it's lightened the load emotionally in a lot of ways. It's been great.
So give me an example of like how that might come up for you. Like if a friend comes to you and they have something like heavy they want to share and you want to be present and listening, but also like not take it on emotionally.
All right. So I give you an example. I got a phone call from a friend late at night a little while back, and called me up. It's like, "Mad, I took some pain meds or something like that." And the dude's been sober for a while. And he's like, "I'm not, you know, I'm just buzzed." And I'm like, "This is not my normal headspace," and blah, blah, blah. He's said, "All right." I said, "Are you worried?" He's like, "I'm not really worried. I just don't want to keep doing this." I said, "Okay, man. Well, let's talk about a plan. What's your plan? What are we going to do tomorrow?" "All right, cool. Great." Kind of paraphrasing that conversation a little bit, but then we hung up. And me from, you know, 5 years ago might have said, "I will be right there. Like, I'm on my way. I'm getting in the car. Let's go."
Dropping everything. You were in the middle of dinner. You're like, "Screw this dinner. I don't need to be nourished. I'm going to help my friend."
Exactly. I would have sacrificed everything to help my friend. And what I've realized in taking care of myself, everyone always says that you can't help anyone until you help yourself. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a very trivial thing, but until I actually started doing it, I didn't understand it. And now that I am putting myself first, I am more stable on my own two feet, and I can help. And I feel like I'm getting derailed in this whole thing.
That's okay. You're safe here.
Yeah. No, thank you. I appreciate that.
It's messy.
It's messy. This whole thing's messy.
Well, what's interesting about like the work of like self-awareness in order to go, you know, inward to go outward, right? Is in that example that you gave, right? Like it could be even like something as simple as you taking a pause and understanding, can I really help here? Right. So before I might have like just gone there and like been present for that person, whatever. But like, is that going to be useful here in this circumstance? Mm-hmm. It could be just as simple as being curious about like, okay, how can I really help in this circumstance? Am I needed there? Like being, you know, taking a step, because I know that I've been that person and have been that person for a lot of people in my life. And I've had to take a step back and I've had to sort of protect myself in a lot of ways so I can, you know, deepen my capacity for love for myself. And then that stuff comes outward and it gets better. I can love in a deeper and more profound way this person who needs help, whereas I couldn't before because I wasn't doing that work, right? Which is the beautiful thing about going inward, right? Because you're getting to know yourself, you're getting to know what fills you up and what's exciting and what fills up, you know, what's your purpose, you know, all that stuff, right? It's important.
All that jazz, you know.
All that jazz. Do you tend to be like the go-to person in your friendship circles, like the people that go to like lean on?
I will say I am leanable. I don't want to, you know.
Madison the leanable.
I am leanable. I try to be dependable for people. I'm not going to say that everyone turns to me, but people do turn to me, and that's nice. That's affirming.
Do you think they turn to you? Like, what would you? This is your opportunity to say. To say how great you are.
Yeah, but I'm not going to do that. I think when people have problems, the best thing you can do for them is to listen. And that's largely what I try to do. I just listen. And, you know, at the end of the conversation, I'll say, do you want help trying to navigate this problem? Or did you just want to talk? And most of the time, they just wanted to talk. They wanted to be heard and seen. So,
I love that.
Maybe that's why. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you do it well, and it's received well, that support. Yeah. So what are, like, now that you're in the space and you're in the world and you're trying to fill up your own cup, like, what is that filling up your own cup look like to you? Like, what is that, like, deepening self-awareness work look like to you?
I mean, going to
therapy is one, right? Going to therapy is great. It's beautiful.
Yes. Going to therapy. For me, it's nurturing my inner child. And, you know, some people take that with a grain of salt, all the inner child work. But to me, the inner child is just the, like, the true self. Mm. So kind of digging past all of the layers that I know that I have, and truly asking myself how I'm doing and what I need. And that kind of, like I said earlier, I didn't ask myself those questions until I became a type 1 diabetic. And with that diagnosis, you know, I would feel like weird or something like that. Like, you know, I didn't really understand how diabetes worked after getting out of the ER in the hospital, and say, okay, well, let's check my sugars. What are my numbers right now? And it's like, okay, my numbers are fine. Well, why do I feel weird? Is it stress? Am I worried about this? And it wasn't an immediate fix. I've been type 1 for 5 years now. And I've just been asking myself for so long that I'm really starting to believe myself. I don't know. It sounds like I'm talking to two different people here, but I'm starting to trust myself.
There you go.
Yes. I don't have to go to therapy this week. I just talked to Known.
I love that. That's so beautiful. And I'd imagine, like, going through that experience, getting diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, it's allowed you or sort of helped you navigate the train the muscles of, like, checking in on yourself, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because you have to, like, physically, you have to. How has that experience been? Like, what, tell me about, like, when you were diagnosed, like, how that felt and how you've grown through that diagnosis.
So I was diagnosed in June of 2017, I think. Let's go with that number. I was right before I turned 27, and my fighting weight is about 125, and I weighed 86 pounds. So I was next to nothing. And I got a new job, and I took my second paycheck from said job and took myself to urgent care. And they did blood work, and they came back 30 minutes later and said, congratulations, you're a type 1 diabetic. You're going straight to the ICU, where you will stay for several days.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. I almost died. It was great.
May I ask, like, was the weight loss or that weight, was that because that you had diabetes?
Yes. So it's called diabetic ketoacidosis.
Oh, wow.
And it's essentially your blood turns to acid, and you can't process sugar. So it just eats itself. Your body eats itself. Eats fat, and then you almost die. It's great.
Wonderful. I mean, were people around you be like, Madison, what's going on?
I had people come up to me afterwards and say, oh, you're diabetic? Yeah, man, we thought you picked up a Coke habit. Like, nobody said anything. But wow. Also, you know, I knew that something was wrong, but I also didn't have health insurance. And so I just convinced myself that things weren't that bad because I didn't think there was a way of fixing it.
Were you in pain?
Yes. I would guess I was type 1 for about 6 months. It kind of, I think the pancreas kind of slowly shuts down rather than, it's not like an on and off switch.
Wow.
But it was about 6 months and like I couldn't get up a flight of stairs without being out of breath. Mm-hmm. I was completely dehydrated. Like my tongue dried out. It's the weirdest thing. My hair dried out. It was so exhaustion mostly. It wasn't like pins and needles kind of pain. It was just like exhaustion.
Yeah. So you go to the ER. They tell you you're type 1 diabetic. Was that relieving? Was that hard to hear?
Kind of. I think there was a small part of me that knew I was very close to dying, but I didn't want to admit it, like I said, because I didn't have health insurance. But that was a relief to at least know what was wrong. I also didn't understand the weight of that diagnosis, like what that meant. What that means for the rest of my life at that time. But yeah, it was definitely a relief.
Mm. So it's been like 5 years. Mm-hmm. I don't, help me understand, like, what is like your day-to-day look like? Because I'm very ignorant when it comes to diabetes. So tell me a little bit about like what your day-to-day is like and what you have to do and be mindful of and all those things.
So type 1 diabetes means that I do not produce my own insulin, which means I function as a pancreas. So my goal always is to keep my blood sugars in range. Mm. And I am lucky enough to have health insurance now. So I have a couple of medical devices that help with that. I have a constant glucose monitor, which sends my sugar, my levels to my phone, which is amazing. So I don't have to do finger sticks as often. Mm-hmm. And I also have an insulin pod, which is like a pump, right? So let's see, day to day, I wake up and I check my sugars and I adjust if I need to. And
what does adjusting look like?
So if I'm too high, my numbers are too high, I have to give myself insulin to bring it back into range. And if I'm too low, I have to, you know, eat a glucose tablet or, depends on how low. So like high sugar levels will kill you slowly over time. And then low sugar levels can kill you immediately. So kind of always playing with death. In many regards.
Yeah. Do you feel like, this is a weird question, but like, I get this sense from you that you have a temperament that's strong and resilient and like you're a fighter. I don't know. I don't know you, but like, I just get that sense. Like, do you feel like your temperament is like, I can handle this. Like, this is no big thing. Or has it been a struggle? Has it been hard?
I am indeed scrappy. I would like to put that down.
Put that on the record.
Yeah, I would like to put that on the record. Thank you. I am scrappy as shit. But this is exhausting. I mean, like I just said, I dabble with death every single day. It's always in the back of my head that I'm a type 1 diabetic. And it's freaking exhausting on so many levels, because not only do I have to think about diabetes all day, every day, and it's not just when it comes to eating food. Like if I want to walk around the block, I have to take my bag with me. I have to take my glucose tabs with me. I have to check my nut. Like I can't just do anything.
Mm.
Every single decision I make is based off of my type 1 diabetes. And so not only do I deal with that all day, every day, I still have to work. I still have to pay my bills. I still have to do all of the things that come with life. And so it's just, it's a lot. So
it is a lot.
It's a little bit, and I don't like feeling vulnerable. Nobody likes feeling vulnerable, but I really don't like it. But it's called burnout, right? When it comes to chronic illness, which means that you just, there's no true definition. It's everybody, you know, defines it as something different. But burnout to me is just when the one thing goes wrong at the wrong time. So like my insulin pod runs out after the most exhausting day ever. And it's just the one thing that, you know, breaks the camel's back. And so for a long time, I tried to fight the burnout. I tried to tell myself that I was not exhausted, that I could fight through it. And within the last couple of years, and the word empathy being at the forefront of my mind, I learned to be empathetic towards myself and allow myself to experience the burnout and, you know, cry if I need to and just be okay with it. So long-winded explanation. Oh my gosh. What was the original question? Okay, cool.
I don't even know. I appreciate you sharing that, and I'm sorry. That sounds really hard, and I'm grateful to hear that you have found some empathy for yourself, because it's I don't have chronic illness, but I have major depressive disorder, and it's relentless, right? And so when you're dealing with something that's a consistent thing that pops up, and it's just ever present. And it's a thing that takes you out of, or maybe your framework says it takes you out of living, or it takes you out of the framework of like a normal life. Mm-hmm. It can be hard. And, you know, I've had moments where I've struggled with suicidal ideation. Like I've just like, I can't deal with this anymore. Right. You know? And so it's fucking hard. And so I'm sorry. And I'm also grateful that you have found some empathy and you found some softness, and that feeling is poured into a beautiful effort in High Risk Humans, which is this photography series that you reached out to me about. You know, you initially contacted me about for this show, which, so tell me a little bit about that. Actually, first, like, define what you mean by High Risk Humans, because it's pretty broad, right? Like, what does it mean to you?
So high risk was the term that the CDC used to define the folks that were most at risk to be killed by COVID-19.
Right.
So that
right.
meant largely it meant underlying medical condition, or those over the age of 65.
Right. Right.
So, yeah. So I was in that category as a type 1 diabetic. It's an autoimmune disease.
And so tell me about the sort of the straw that broke the camel's back moment when you sort of came up with this idea.
So, all of our experiences with the beginnings of COVID were pretty similar. We were all locked down. We were all depressed and sad, and all the worlds had stopped. Whenever I tell the story, I always have to mention that, like, my lowest point was when John Prine died. He was killed by COVID-19, and he was an absolute hero of mine. And so when he was killed, I like went out into the driveway and just cried, laid on the ground and cried. It wrecked me. And 2 weeks later, I think this was May of 2022. 2 weeks later, there were protests in downtown Nashville where people demanded the reopening of businesses. They were tired of lockdown. And a woman...
May of 2021?
2020. Sorry.
2020. You said 2022.
So no. Like, okay. Now it's 2022. Sorry.
That's right.
Time's
okay.
Weird.
When is what?
Time is still really.
It was just a couple months into the pandemic.
Yes. Thank you for clarifying to you and all of the listeners. So May of 2020, this woman held a sign at this protest that said sacrifice the weak. And the weak was referring to the high risk. It was referring to myself. It was referring to friends of mine. And like I said, I thought the death of John Prine was my lowest point. And then a woman held that sign and it put me in bed for 3 days because a stranger had decided what my life was worth. And she said it was worth absolutely nothing. And then on that third day, I had an idea where I wanted to photograph the high risk so that when somebody said sacrifice the weak, I could show them exactly who they were referring to. I wanted to humanize it. I wanted to put faces to that statistic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I texted some friends that were high risk and I said, I don't know what I'm doing, but can I photograph you? And said, yes, absolutely. And it kind of naturally turned into interviews, and the website came along shortly thereafter. And next thing you know, we have a COVID-19 based photo series that is meant to showcase the broad range of individuals that fall into the high risk category. And I set out to, when I started the project, I was angry and I thought that I was directing the project towards those that said sacrifice the weak.
Mm-hmm.
But what ended up happening is that it helped the high risk and those that love them, because the high risk were all locked down and we had to be more cautious, and you know, the social media and all that were saying that we weren't worth anything. And so this project spoke for them and it said, you are worthy. And, you know, it made folks feel seen and heard during a depressively isolating time. So it's something I'm very proud of, honestly.
You should be. It's great. Yeah, it's a wonderful idea and it's a beautiful act of empathy. For me, actually, side note, did you happen to get the name of the person carrying that sign?
No,
was her name Karen?
Actually, what's worse than a Karen? It's whatever it is worse than a Karen. No, she actually had her face covered.
Gotcha. So it's a beautiful series, and it, to me, what has been like this time, and by that I mean the pandemic and you know, which is still around and still exists.
Still technically
people.
Around. Yeah. It's still a thing, guys.
Things are spiking.
Yeah.
I mean, I know we're tired and I know it's exhausting and I know we want to get back, and I'm not trying to belittle social experience, and you know, that stuff's valuable, and so are the most vulnerable, right? So like my empathy has been challenged and it has been, it's grown in immense ways over the last couple of years, to consider. I think what is beautiful about the project High Risk Humans is it asks us or reminds us that our empathy goes beyond just our inner circles, right? It to me, like that says, there are people around us in our communities. We may not even know them. And the way I operate in the world has an impact on them, right? And could potentially kill them, mm-hmm. right? So small things I can do to mitigate risk and to ensure that the most vulnerable among us are as safe as possible, mm-hmm. I feel like it's the least of our duties. But you know, some don't, and I that sort of divide is interesting, and I've been exploring it more in some of my empathy workshops and talking about. I have a slide that says empathy and the people who bug us, and it's meant to sort of like really get us thinking about like, yeah, we have differences, and let's not stop there, right? This is not a binary lens with which we look at the world, right? The person holding that sign, yeah, it's vile. And it understandably made you angry and upset. It would make me angry and upset. And what else is going on there, right? Like that's the and piece and the sort of the context and the curiosity that could maybe not bridge a gap or agree to disagree or come to, you know, not get to some we are one place, yeah. But it's to just deepen our curiosity about, okay, what is behind this, right? Probably a lot of fear and anxiety too, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
It's hard.
Yeah, I've been asked before, you know, like, well, what would you say to this woman if you could, you know, speak with her? And I would just want to know how she's doing. And, you know, it's been 2 years since she held that sign. And through my work with the series and striving to be empathetic in everything I do, that sign screams anger, right? But anger is a product of fear, as you said. Like, you look past the anger on that sign, and it's in their fear. If people weren't afraid of the virus, they were afraid of losing their jobs, or they were afraid of losing their homes, or how they were going to put food on the table. Everyone was scared at that time.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if you say otherwise, you are lying to me. But so No, I don't think that we're ever going to sing Kumbaya together, me and that woman. But I do want to know how she's doing. I want to know if she's okay. I want to know if she made it through. And I empathize with how scared she was.
Right. Right. What is, like, important to me, and I think speaks volumes to this series that you've done, High Risk Humans, is like, it's not like, it's maybe even like easier, like, quote unquote, easier to, like, say, oh, this person's immunocompromised, or this person has type 1 diabetes, or this person, whatever, right? And then there's so much intersectionality. Then there's layers of, like, marginalization, poverty, you know, black and brown bodies being impacted by COVID-19 at higher rates. Like, there's all this intersectionality at play that is, like, so crucial in the empathy work and the nuance when we're talking about the context of a global killer. And I bring that up because I think, like, projects like this can open a door into that type of empathy work and that frame of thinking, which I think is so important, because the world is fucking overwhelming, and it's overwhelming, right? Like, wars are happening and it's scary. And we want to hunker down into our bubbles, and we want to get into our safety. And that's understandable. We all need to do that. And I think we also need to open. We also need to open up and, you know, able, like, non-immunocompromised people like myself need to be bold and be brave in sort of my advocacy and how I show up in the world and how I speak about some of these things and talking about vaccines and masks and, you know, and so forth. Because, I mean, I'm not saying I'm the one to do that, but, like, I think we all do. And I think it's just, this time has really been hard. This time has been hard, and it's messed with my own sense of self, and it's messed with my own sense of empathy. And I've been understandably angry at times, and I've been understandably moved at times. And I want more humans in the world to consider others. Let's just call it that. Consider others.
Yeah.
Others outside of your circle, others outside of the people you know. I don't know. And that takes that takes work, right?
I didn't think it would be that difficult of an ask to like maybe kind of consider looking out for your neighbor, but some people were just totally against it. And
against your project?
Against the idea of caring for your neighbor.
Oh.
Wear a mask because this person needs you to. Well, screw that person. But I think that what was so overwhelming is that, you know, largely it had to do with the politics of that time, but due to social media and politics of that time, it seemed like there were more of those unkind people than there actually were. I think those people with that sacrifice of weak rhetoric are just loud.
Sure.
And I think they take up a lot of space. I'm trying to be positive, but I really think that the majority of people are willing to be kind. It's just the ones that aren't are ridiculously loud.
You may be right. And you may be wrong.
I you know what? I may be wrong, but that idea is what got me through, you know, those really dark times. I had to believe that there were more kind-hearted individuals in this world than unkind.
Yeah. Yeah. It's important. And I think you're right. I think there is, especially at that time, there was a lot of, I mean, this is what like politics or these type of frameworks can do. It's just, they just pit us against each other and all reason and curiosity is thrown out the window. Right. And so all of a sudden getting a vaccination or wearing a mask is you being a sheep or a lib, you know, or whatever. Yeah. Right. Which is asinine, but yeah. Yeah. How do you think, like, you know, since doing that series, since the early pandemic, from the time you saw that sign, and, you know, we're 2 years plus removed, right? Like, how do you think that our consideration for others has gotten better, changed?
I want to be hopeful, but... what I think has happened is that this whole pandemic has exposed like the underbelly of our society. Mm. And I don't think people are necessarily more willing to be kind. It's just become very apparent to people who are not willing to be kind. So like pre-pandemic, those that were willing to look out for their neighbors were always willing to look out for their neighbors. And those that were not, were always not.
Right. Yeah.
It created a stark divide.
I mean, it feels like it was always there, but it certainly has exacerbated a lot of binary thinking. But when it comes to a concept such as empathy or kindness, it's not a binary thing. It's messy. And it takes work and consideration and pause, you know. And so those two forces seem at odds. And that's hard. And that's the piece of it. Like when I'm doing this podcast or I'm leading workshops for Feely Human and whatnot, that's the piece of it on a grand scale that overwhelms me. And it feels like I'm not making any difference. And I need to remind myself and you, Madison, and the listeners that like you are, like we are making a difference. if we are showing up in the way that we're showing up, you know, and it could just be a friend sort of seeing how that, you know, being witness to how empathetic we are, or an act of empathy that we've shown someone else and they've been witness to that and are inspired. It could be as simple as that, right? And I think I have to remind myself of that daily, because it is, I mean, we've lost a million lives in the US alone.
Here's where the confetti cannons go off. A million lives.
Yeah. A million. It's
a million lives.
It's
a million.
It's horrifying. Horrifying. Yeah. And that's a piece of it that's like so hard to understand, or so hard to like hold, because like I even have people I love and cherish who have different varying levels of like comfortability with like how they show up in a pandemic, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas like I'm still wearing a mask in public indoor spaces, like at the grocery store, Trader Joe's, whatnot, because I feel like, you know, I'm like, I don't go anywhere, you know, and I don't, you know, I'm not like, I haven't had COVID, thank goodness. I don't want it. But I do it for others, right? Mm-hmm. I do it because a person there may be immunocompromised, whatever. But every time I'm going nowadays, 95% of the people there without masks. And part of me is like, these fucking morons. You know, part of me like wants to like get on my soapbox and like, you idiots, you know, like have an opposite sacrifice the weak sign. whatever that looks like. Protect the weak, I guess. But so I have to like, I have to sort of check in my own sort of knee-jerk response to that and say like, well, they're responding to it differently. Doesn't necessarily mean it's wrong.
Yeah.
Right. But it's messy. It's hard, because I do want people to think about it. I do want, and that's the piece that's hard to me sometimes. It's like, I don't want to come across that like I am some know-it-all and that I'm right. It's not a matter of that. It's a matter of like, if there is a chance that I could give someone a life-threatening illness, I'm just going to wear a mask just to be safe, just to make sure that I'm protecting others. Like, it's as simple as that for me. And so, but I can't put that simple sort of math onto someone else, because they have a different life experience.
Right. And maybe a different equation. Maybe that's not the same, you know, variables that they were given.
Right.
And it just gets all convoluted, and it's really difficult, man. It's really difficult. So I had a conversation very, very early on into the lockdown with a friend from like 20 yards away. We were like so far away from each other. But he was talking about like, I need to still go to the grocery store. I still have to go to work. Like, I can't, I'm sorry, man, but I can't stop. Like, there's, and so when he said that, I realized that all I wanted from people, all I wanted to ask of people was to do it as safely as possible. Mm-hmm. I only wanted you to just consider your neighbor. Like, mm-hmm. I know you can't not go to the grocery store. Like, I understand that. I understand that you still have to put food on the table. I get it. My only ask was that you maybe do it with me in mind.
Yeah. And was he receptive to that?
Oh, yeah. No, it was a difficult conversation, but we both agreed that, like, I guess we agreed not disagree, but yeah, he's like, no, I get it. I'll do my best. And I was like, cool, great. Do your best. I'll see you around.
You end the conversation like launching like water balloons at each other 20 yards away. Yeah,
exactly.
I hear that and I appreciate it. And I want more. Hmm. Like, I want to hold humanity to a higher standard. I do. Oh, and maybe that's the utopian in me. And maybe I am like setting myself for failure every day of my life, but I don't care. That's right. I don't know. I feel, yeah, I don't know. I feel like I'm making myself out in this conversation to be some sort of like martyr or whatever, but I'm really doing my best because I care deeply about empathy and about what empathy looks like in community. And I care deeply about community because I don't believe that this notion of individualism is really that valuable to me. I believe that it's in community where we truly grow and learn and heal. And if I'm taking that framework and perspective into the context of a global pandemic, I think about these things constantly.
Yeah.
And I get on my soapbox because I'm passionate. But I'm also just a very privileged white cis silly boy, who got kicked out of a water park for life as a teenager. True story.
Nice. That's epic.
I was a anarchic punk kid who wanted to be away from home because home was the worst.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's messy. And I I hope you listeners that you check out the High Risk Humans series. So I noticed that. Are you still taking pictures?
I haven't done any in a while, but if somebody reached out to me, I'd still gladly listen to their story and take their picture. Pandemic's not over. I mean, that's not.
No, it's not.
We're still doing it.
Yeah, we're still doing it. Good. So I want people to go check out High Risk Humans. I'll make sure to include the links and stuff in the show notes because it is very powerful and it does really offer up. I'll just say what it offered up to me. It reminded me like, oh, I didn't even realize someone like yourself having type 1 diabetes would be someone at high risk. So that was like a miss on my part. So I appreciated the sort of insight into the wide spectrum of what that means, right? And that's millions of people. That's a lot of people, right?
Yeah, I think, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, go ahead.
I think it was like 10% or maybe 9%, something like that, of the world's population is high risk, which you think, it's just 10%. I'm like, but that's how many millions and millions of people. And it's not just the high risk. It's those that love them.
Yep.
They're not, high risk life is not a singular point of impact. When you lose that person, the ripples of that loss move through a community. It affects everybody.
It does. Yeah, absolutely. The friends, the family, the people that they work with, all of it. It touches everything. Yeah. I love it. The website is highriskhumans.com.
Yes, it is. Good job.
Great. So the listeners that will be in the show notes at feelyhuman.co. I feel like I've talked a lot in this conversation. Sorry. I was like a little wayward and all over the place. So, sorry.
No, it's great, man. I love listening to people. I love listening to people's stories. I think listening is an act of kindness. It's one of the most simple things you can do, but it's the most appreciated.
Listening is great. It's a crucial part of empathy. Yeah, absolutely. So are you still like, I notice on Instagram, you're still taking pictures. Is that your day job or you just take pictures of concerts and whatnot?
Yeah. So I live in Nashville, Music City. I'm a music photographer, like anything to do with musicians, concerts, promotional stuff, album artwork, actually working on a project for Dolly Parton right now, which
what?
Is kind of why. Yeah.
She's amazing.
She is amazing. I'm helping archive her wardrobe.
Wow.
She has, she has everything she's ever worn all the way back to the Porter Wagoner days.
Wow. So, and you're taking pictures of these.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. It's something like 6,000. It's a lot. It's a lot.
Wow. Did you have to sign like an NDA or something?
Yes, but I have been given approval to at least give you that much information.
Got it. That's so cool.
Yeah.
When is this thing going to be public at some point, this project? Or is it just...
Some of it might be. I'm not really... We're just creating a database so they know what they have.
Got it. Right. Wow. Now. That's so cool. Have you met her?
I got to work with her last year. My boss, Stacey Huckabee, one of the best photographers in Nashville, or, you know, broader range than that, is Dolly's photographer. And so we did the Run Rose Run album artwork last summer.
That's so cool.
Last summer. So yeah, to answer your question, yes. And she is a delight. And she does not walk. She, you know, glides across the ground and
yeah,
emits
of course.
Rainbows. And yeah, she's just
butterflies and yeah, all of it. Yeah.
Deer follow her around. It's yeah. Wildlife, the whole thing.
Yeah. Birds chirping. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's expected. That's yeah. That's so cool.
Everything so cool. You read about, it's true. She's just a delight.
That's amazing. It's been probably 25 years since I've been to Tennessee. It's been a long time. I should visit again. I was much younger then.
Do
you like living there?
Nashville's great. I love Nashville very much. It's a town based on music. I mean, how amazing is that?
Yeah.
It runs on music and musicians and artistry. And it's like a collective. But we mm-hmm. are a blue dot in a red state. I definitely live in the South.
Yeah. Yeah. How does that feel?
It made the pandemic really difficult.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. A woman that lived... Or I lived a mile from where those protests happened. Someone held a sign that said sacrifice the week. And that's a large part of the state feels that way, I think.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's a bummer, man.
Yeah. And right now I know in Tennessee, they're basically stripping all right to abortion, which is ungood.
Ungood. I will say it's wonderful to see so many people turning up to those protests. You know, men and women and people of all ages and color and creed are showing up to try and prevent that from happening.
Yeah. Well, yeah, keep fighting, I guess. keep being scrappy, keep being your scrappy self.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Madison, let's talk about empathy heroes. So this is the part of the show where my guest, you, and I mention someone in our lives. Could be a musician, could be a character from a story, could be a friend, etc. Someone who's empathetic, someone we love and cherish. I'll go first to give you a moment to reflect.
Thank you.
Yeah. you look like deer in the headlights. You'll be okay.
Yeah.
I mean, you could use Dolly Parton.
Shoot. Okay.
My empathy hero this week is my friend David. So I won't get into the particulars of our conversation, but we had a disagreement about something last week, and I had asked for something as a friend, and the response was unexpected, and he called me like a few days later and apologized, which I felt was very beautiful and vulnerable and brave to do, because as you know, it's hard to admit when you make a mistake or you're wrong or whatever it may be, you messed up. Right. And he shared that he had been struggling and, you know, and providing some context, you know, And I was moved by it and touched by it. And, you know, because there was a moment there where I was like, am I going to lose a friend?
Aww.
Like, I can't, like, that. And that would have been really hard. And that would have been a big grief for me. And I feel like the reality is I've lost a lot of friends the past 10 years because I've changed a lot. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens when you change and grow and people are left behind, right? Like, there's just part of the equation. Like, with change comes grief and loss, right? So anyways, I just wanted to shout out David because I love David and I appreciate his heart. And I'm excited, just in a couple of weeks, we're going backpacking in Sequoia National Park. So yeah, David's my empathy hero this week.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I'm glad that story ended the way it did.
Thank you.
That's awesome. My empathy hero, and this is the first person that popped into my head, is Fiona Prine, John Prine's wife, widow now, unfortunately. And I don't know her, but she is one of the strongest people that I've ever witnessed. And I follow her on social media, and when John passed away, she was honest about what she was feeling. And she was so vulnerable, and it was so beautiful, because I feel like if she had just gone on social media and said, thank you for your outpouring of love, grief, and I'll be okay, it would have made me feel like I was the odd one out. It would have isolated me because I was grieving the way I was grieving. But for her to come out here, to go on social media and say, this is what I'm struggling with today. She always ended it with, on a positive note. You know, it wasn't doom and gloom, and she had every right to be doom and gloom if she wanted to, but she would go on there and she would say, this is what I'm feeling. This is how I'm feeling. This is why I'm feeling. And you know what? That's okay. And I'm getting teary thinking about it. And it's just, you know, social media post by a stranger, but it empowered me at a time when it was difficult to feel things. It made it okay to feel things.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, it's so important, I think, to be open about how we're feeling, right? Because it's loss is hard, and grief is such a fickle thing that, you know, I think you used isolation at the top of the conversation. Like, it makes you feel isolated and makes you feel strange in a way that's like, I don't know how to do this. And as part of that feeling, you just feel alone in it. So when someone can offer up their own vulnerability and share just what they're feeling, yeah, it makes you feel seen and heard. And that's a crucial human experience. I love it. Well, Madison, where else, also highriskhumans.com, where else can folks connect with you and learn more about the work you're doing?
Well, you're gonna have to edit out me stumbling over self-promotion. I mean, so the High Risk Human series has its own website and its own Instagram page, but then my projects, the concert work I do, the album artwork and stuff, is under my name, just madisonthorne.com, where there's an Instagram page and all that fun jazz.
Great. So
follow along in the shenanigans of surviving in Music City.
I love it. Do you have a hard time promoting yourself?
Absolutely. And it's uncomfortable. Funny. I was just talking about this with a friend. It's like, if somebody wants me to talk about my personal photography work, my stuff, I'll be like, it's good. Yeah, you know, it's great. It's cool. But we've just sat and talked about the High Risk Human series for an hour and a half. And it's because it's not just my story. There's so many stories involved with that. And like I said, I'm proud of it. And I'm proud of every single person that spoke with me, because it took strength and it took vulnerability. It took so much, and it's wonderful. I'm honored that those people spoke with me and entrusted me that much.
And I hope for you too that you can see that the other work you do is wonderful and beautiful as well, and worthy of talking about, right? And I get it. I'm 40. I'll be 41 in July. I still struggle with it too. But I, as I've softened into it and have tried to be proud about some of the things I do, it's allowed me to do bigger and brighter things for the people I love, you know? So just remember that.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. You're welcome. Well, Madison, this was lovely. Thank you for hearing me blab and get on my high horse about empathy in the pandemic. I appreciate you.
Oh, this has been fun, man. All of the emotions, all the feelings. It's been a blast. Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And to you listeners, as I always say, I'm here, you're here. We're here together on this wayward, overwhelming, awe-inspiring, pale blue dot. We have each other. It's Yumi Empathy.